Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner says that one of the best places to hide from intimacy and closeness is in a relationship. Sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Well, we'll find out how bad or dysfunctional relationships actually work for us. But more importantly, we'll find out how to get out of them. And we'll find out how to help heal a broken heart and much, much more around 12:35 today. His new book is called Irrelationship. First, by the year 2020, the number of women who'll be older than 55 is estimated to be 46 million in America. With increasing life expectancy, many women will spend up to 40% of their lives in postmenopausal stage. And half of all women who reach age 50 will live to be at least 80. And an estimated 6,000 US women reach menopause every day. So I sat down a couple of weeks ago and I talked with one of the nation's leading experts on menopause. There's nothing she doesn't cover in this book. Some of the information you probably already know, but I'm betting there's a lot in there that you don't know. It is based on the latest scientific research, and it's also based on her years of helping women get through this period of their life with as much joy and well-being as possible. So let me tell you a little bit more about my guest. Dr. Stephanie Fabian is the director of the Women's Health Clinic in the Department of Internal Medicine at Mayo Clinic. She's one of, as I said, one of the nation's leading experts on menopause. And the book is called Mayo Clinic, The Menopause Solution, A Doctor's Guide to Relieving Hot Flashes, Enjoying Better Sex, Sleeping Well, Controlling Your Weight, and being happy. And we're going to bring that interview to you right now for the first time on Conversations Live, Dr. Stephanie Fabian. So Dr. Fabian, I've been doing shows like this for more than a decade, and there's so much conflicting information out there, so many myths presented as facts about this subject. And I read that even as an MD, you're struck by how much misinformation is out there, how much unreliable information is out there. And so in part, that's why this book, The Menopause Solution, was developed. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yes, you know, I have the privilege of practicing in a menopause clinic at Mayo Clinic, and it's an incredibly rewarding practice. But when women were asking me for information and sources of information, I actually couldn't find anything that I would truly recommend to my patients. And it was so frustrating that we actually decided to do the book because of the lack of information available to women. You know how when you first get your period and you're in fifth grade, you get a class. When you are pregnant and you have a baby, you often get a book or have a class. But nobody does this at menopause. Nobody prepares women in a systematic way for what's going to happen to them. And I think women are confused about the symptoms that they're experiencing. They often don't even know what's happening to them. So that's why we wrote this book.
Right. And one thing you say that is clear, menopausal symptoms aren't as limited in duration as we previously thought. Like at one time, we never used to hear about perimenopause or postmenopause. It was just menopause, and it was just, you know, supposed to be a year or 2 years, whatever. And now it seems that some people are in that menopausal state for many years.
Well, so menopause is defined as no period for a year, and now women are actually living up to 40% of their lifespan after this menopausal transition. So we're living for a long time after menopause. Now, in terms of symptoms, you're right. We used to tell women that symptoms would last a year or two. They would get past it. It would be no big deal. And now we know that, on average, hot flashes and night sweats last 7 to 9 years. But for a good 30% or more of us, we have moderately severe hot flashes and night sweats for a decade or more. So we're not talking about, when we talk about solutions, it's not necessarily a short-term fix. We need to come up with some longer solutions or longer duration solutions for these women.
Right. And so I couldn't believe, I was gasping when you said some people are going to have that for 10 years. That was like, I didn't realize it was that long for some people. That's quite shocking. So let's look at some of the most common misconceptions that you hear in your practice about menopause. What would they be?
Well, one, as we just talked about, is the duration of symptoms. It's much longer than a lot of people believe. Another one is that it's just hot flashes and night sweats. Really, is there anything else associated with menopause? But the symptoms associated with menopause are highly variable, and it's not just the hot flashes and the night sweats. It's also sleep disturbance, mood changes. A lot of women have anxiety and irritability. We also get other body symptoms, even joint aches that are associated with menopause, and that's only recently been recognized as a symptom that's very common in menopause. So there's a wide variety of symptoms that can go along with this transition. It's not just all about hot flashes and night sweats anymore.
Right, and this book is full of information. It's almost like a mini encyclopedia of everything that could be wrong with your body during that period of time. One of the most common issues I think we probably hear about, I don't know if this is the most common in your clinic, but I hear a lot of friends talk about weight gain that is uncontrollable. They seem not to be able to lose that. So what is it that's changing in our body that makes it so difficult for some people to lose that weight around that time?
Well, that's a great question, and that is one of the most common complaints that women are talking about when they come in my clinic. They are most frustrated by weight, and we recently looked at our patient population, and one of the most common symptoms that was associated with a negative view about menopause was weight gain. So this is a big deal for women, but what we know is there are at least three things that are going on that make this more likely around menopause. And one is that our metabolic rate tends to slow a little bit around this transition, so we're burning fewer calories at baseline. Two, we tend to move a little bit less, and it could be lifestyle stuff. It may be that the kids are no longer at home, but studies have shown that we move less. And the third thing is that every last little bit of fat that we have tends to migrate to the midsection. So we have a fat redistribution that's happening around the midsection, too. So those are three really frustrating things. And I have women coming in all the time saying, I'm doing the same things I've always done. I exercise this much. I eat this much. It's always worked in the past, and it doesn't work for me anymore. And they're right. I tell them, I validate that, and I say, yes, you're right. Somebody changed the rules of your body and forgot to tell you.
Right.
So the rules change, and that women really need to change that balance to make it to where they're not gaining weight. And that's hard to do. You have to exercise a little bit more, eat a fewer calories, and then you find that new balance of how you can maintain your weight.
Right. Well, I think it was Mae West who said aging isn't for sissies. And I think she kind of hit the nail on the head there. I liked that you included a whole chapter in the book about coming to grips with changing. Well, you're changing body and you're changing appearance. Because I think many people do get upset about what's happening. I think there's good reason our eyesight fades a little as we get older. It kind of softens the wrinkles when we look in the mirror. So tell us a little bit about how you talk to women about embracing this situation, because it's not going to go away. We have to deal with it. So how do we get our mind around it? And then we'll look at some physical solutions after.
Well, I think that's a really good point you make, and that we as women are so critical about our own bodies. We're not very accepting of the changes that come with menopause and with aging. And part of this is learning to be less critical of ourselves and more accepting of these changes, and that's hard to do. So if you're constantly holding yourself up to a standard of a 20-year-old, it's going to be frustrating every day, because every day you're not going to meet that standard. And it's not realistic for us to meet that standard, but we constantly have these messages bombarded at us from media, movies, et cetera. It's the focus is on youth. Whereas I think we need to embrace these changes and our aging, and we are gaining a lot of things too, including wisdom. I mean, I doubt many of us at 50 would tell you that they truly want to go back and be a 20-year-old again. So I think we need to just look at it in a different way and embrace these changes that are happening, but that can be challenging, and sometimes we need help doing that.
Right, right. Movement, we know, is critical at any age, but especially as we get older. And the reasons aren't just physiological, they're psychological too. You say that you call sitting the new smoking, and it's something I complain about a lot because we're kind of stuck to our computers. Even when I go to my doctors now, I find they often have their back to me because they're working on the computer and taking notes. So everybody's roles have changed. Talk to us a little bit about movement and why that's so important and how it helps us mentally.
Well, I think you've hit on a key thing here, and that is physical activity is so incredibly important, and people dedicate their lives on researching this and talking about it. But you're right, we are a more sedentary society, and our workplaces are often built around this. But I can tell you, I just got a standing desk at my office, and so now I can stand. And I will give an example of my old mentor, and he is in his mid-80s now. He gets on the treadmill, which is in his office, every time he gets on the phone. And he is walking about 13 miles a day. So every time he picks up the phone and gets on, he's on the treadmill just at a walking pace. So there are things that we can do every day, and whether it's getting an exercise ball and replacing your chair with an exercise ball and working your core, or whether it's getting something that encourages movement, there are little cycle things that go under your desk. All of us need to figure out how to move more during our day. We've instituted walking meetings and that sort of thing, so figuring out how to incorporate activity into your daily life is incredibly important, and that is going to pay off in many ways in the future, including better cardiovascular health, better mood, lower stress levels, etc.
I like the idea of having walking meetings. I've done those myself because we don't need to be sitting all around a table to have a meeting. I think that's a great idea. We're going to take a very quick break. My guest is Dr. Stephanie Fabian, and the Mayo Clinic has put out this book, The Menopause Solution, A Doctor's Guide to Relieving Hot Flashes, Enjoying Better Sex, Sleeping Well, Controlling Your Weight, and Being Happy. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, New York Times bestselling author of The Perfect Storm and War, Sebastian Younger, tackles today's challenges in America brought about by our loss of community with his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. We'll also hear from National Geographic writer and author of The World's Wackiest Roadside Attractions. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Working hard to put a smile on your face. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My special guest in this segment is Dr. Stephanie Fabian. She's with the Mayo Clinic, and we're talking today about the menopause solution. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Fabian, because I've never heard this anywhere else before, that baby boomers, you recommend baby boomers get a hepatitis C blood test. You say they're 5 times more likely than other adults to be infected with hep C. So tell us about that. Why?
Well, that's actually a CDC recommendation that's come out recently. So they have found that we just have a large percentage of the population in the baby boomer age range that has hepatitis C, and it's not been detected thus far. So most of them are not aware of the infection. So that's a new CDC guideline that came out. And the reason for the infections in that age group is unclear. It could be blood transfusions before we were actually screening for hepatitis C. But yes, that's a new recommendation from the CDC.
Okay. And so so do we know why we're more likely, or baby boomers are more likely to have hepatitis C?
I think probably because we just didn't have some of the screenings available before for some of the blood products, but that's my guess.
Okay.
I'm not an expert in that field, though.
All right. So I want to look at some of the things which are a little controversial. And, of course, the first one is hormone therapy. I've interviewed myself doctors who say absolutely do not do hormone therapy. I've interviewed others who said, of course you must do hormone therapy if it's going to help you. So in your book, you write about who should use hormone therapy and who should avoid it. So let's talk about that if we can, please.
A little bit on hormone therapy. And so the Women's Health Initiative study was that big study that came out in 2002 and scared everybody half to death about hormone therapy. And everybody who was on hormone therapy stopped taking hormone therapy at that time. But since then, new studies and re-examination of that study have led us to understand that it's not all black and white, and that for younger women who are in their 50s, within 10 years of menopause, and who are basically healthy women, the benefits of hormone therapy actually outweigh the risks. And we've paid a cost for avoiding hormone therapy over the last decade in these women. And you're right, there are some physicians who flat out will not prescribe hormone therapy. And I think that's a lack of education, actually. And there are certainly women who should take hormone therapy. So let's talk about who is the most appropriate candidate for hormone therapy, and that would be younger women who are pretty bothered by their symptoms. So it's getting in the way of their daily activities, they're not sleeping at night, they're waking up fatigued during the day, they're having trouble getting through their day. Those women are good candidates for hormone therapy if they're basically healthy. Now, there are also women who probably shouldn't take hormone therapy, and those women include breast cancer survivors, for example. Some women may choose not to take hormone therapy, and for those women who are having symptoms, we have some other non-hormonal prescription therapies that are available. They're not as effective as hormone therapy, but there are some treatments that do seem to work fairly well.
Right. I know my own sister is taking hormone therapy because she got to a point where she just said she felt enraged all the time, and she's a very happy, lucky-go person, so they put her on hormone therapy, and it has helped her, but you know, she hasn't been on it that long yet. It's good that we have the choice, though, and it's good to bring these conversations to the table because, you know, as you stress in the book, there's so much misinformation out there, and it comes down to, you know, who do you believe at the end of the day? So it's great that you put book out, yeah. So another controversial thing, breast screening. You know, I know that the medical insurance companies were against doing screening so often. And even in your book, you talk about the difference between American Cancer Society recommendations and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations. Even those differ. So tell us about the latest news on screening guidelines for breast cancer.
Well, I think the breast cancer screening guideline issue is still in flux. And I think there's a lot of information out there that screening is good. So we know screening's a good thing. Mammography has been the typical screening method that we've used thus far, but mammography is far from perfect. And we know that for women with denser breasts, which is roughly half the population, that screening mammography is not as good at detecting breast cancers as it is for those women who have less dense breasts. So there is a definite need for better screening technologies, and there are many that are being developed currently. And I think the screening guidelines are sort of reflecting the fact that mammography is not perfect, particularly for women with denser breasts. Now, it also goes back to what interval is correct, and between the different guidelines, the screening recommendations are every year to every 2 years, and the data is somewhat murky on whether screening yearly is better than screening every 2 years. And for instance, here at Mayo, they're currently re-examining their screening guideline recommendations to see if the evidence does indeed support screening on an annual basis. And I think that debate will go on. But in the meantime, there are other screening methods available, like tomosynthesis, which adds some more imaging to breast to mammography. And there's also things like molecular breast imaging that image the breast in a different way. And I think this field will continue to evolve to where we have a better way of screening these women with denser breasts. So stay tuned. I know there's a lot of controversy out there. The key is that we need to continue screening in some way, because this is still a big thing that that impacts women. I mean, 1 in 8 women will have breast cancer in her lifetime, so this is important. I think we haven't perfected how we screen yet.
Right, right. And in addition to doing the monthly breast exam ourselves, which is recommended, there are actual visual breast changes to look for. I wonder if we could cover some of those, like dimpling, inflammation, etc.
Yes, and actually we're not recommending monthly breast exams. We're now recommending self-breast awareness. So that's slightly different in that we're not saying once a month examine your breasts. We're saying pay attention to your breasts. So pay attention to changes. And some of the changes that we're talking about are just what you mentioned. So I find that women tend to ignore some of the changes, even if they identify them. So I've had a couple of women in the last 2 years who have ignored rashes on their breasts. So women need to understand that even a nipple rash or a rash on your breast that doesn't go away, that needs to be looked at and that can't be ignored. So it's not just a lump or a bump. Certainly a lump or a bump anywhere on your chest or under your armpit needs to be examined further. But even nipple discharge, especially bloody nipple discharge, rashes, even a blush over the breast, or pulling or puckering or dimpling over the breast needs to be looked at. So all of these changes, pretty much any change you can think of on your chest in general, needs to be checked out if it persists.
Okay. And so then what about pain? Because this is another thing that I've heard very conflicting information on. If you feel pain, you say it probably is nothing, but you should go have it checked out, right?
So pain, breast cancer usually is not painful. So I will reassure people, first and foremost, breast cancer usually is not painful. That's not always, but usually. Now, some of the first things to look at, women often come in with underwire bras, and those can cause pain. Sometimes just pulling of the breast on the chest wall can even strain a muscle. That can cause pain. Sometimes even just sleeping with a sports bra to support the breast can be helpful. Things like caffeine can increase cyclical pain. So there are different things that we can look at to try to reduce pain. And I do recommend that women with pain get checked out if the pain is persistent. But I would also encourage them to look at their bra and make sure that their bra fits appropriately.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's look at cognitive decline. This is another thing that I frequently hear if I go to like women's network groups. They say, "Oh, I'm getting very forgetful," or I feel befuddled. My head feels muddled a lot of the time. How do we tell the difference between simply being befuddled and forgetful versus the beginnings of a serious disease like Alzheimer's?
Yes, my teenage daughter accuses me of having Alzheimer's. There are definitely changes in the menopausal transition and reasons why we might have what is commonly termed brain fog. So when women are going through menopause, we're frequently not only busy and going in 80 different directions, but we're not sleeping well, and then we might be a little irritable during the day, and it's difficult to think and concentrate, and we have that quote-unquote brain fog. So it is not uncommon at all for women to complain of these cognitive issues in the menopausal transition. The good news is that those seem to get better as we go through menopause. So those changes in menopause are most often not a more serious concern. But certainly as we age, we're at greater risk for dementia and for Alzheimer's disease, and that is a widespread problem that is more common in women than men. And that is not even taking into account the fact that we live longer, but it is simply more common in women than in men. So it is a concern. Early onset menopause is rare. But if there are changes that seem out of the ordinary in you or your loved one, that should definitely get checked out.
Okay. Dr. Fabian, earlier you mentioned mood changes. Other than, you know, looking at, into hormone therapy, which we talked about, what can people do to try and alleviate those mood swings, if anything?
It's just simple mood changes. We can certainly work on stress management, regular exercise, that sort of thing can actually help some of the more minor changes. As you mentioned, hormone therapy can be effective for even a mild depression. But for anything more than that, women need to see their medical providers to see if more treatment is necessary. So hormone therapy is certainly not going to take care of a major depressive episode. And we need to keep in mind that this hormonal transition at menopause is a time of vulnerability for women in terms of mood. So women who have had, say, PMS or baby blues in the past are more likely to have a hormone-related mood issue at menopause. So those women need to take particular care during this time of transition.
Okay. And then my last question for you is about sex drive. Many people say they lose their sex drive, they lose interest in it, which of course can cause problems if they're in a relationship. What advice do you give to women about that?
So I think first acknowledging that there are changes in sex drive around menopause. A lot of women and their partners don't recognize this, and so it's important to understand that before menopause, we might have had a spontaneous sex drive, spontaneous sexual thoughts and fantasies. But when we lose that hormone-based drive, it becomes more of a responsive or willingness desire that we have. And so that means that we might not initiate sexual activity, but in the right circumstances, so right place, right time, right situation, we might be willing to be sexual. And so just that shift, we and our partners need to understand that that's really happened. And we often encourage women to be a little more planful about sexual activity, so it might not occur to them to be sexual, and therefore sometimes we have to plan it. And that, while that sounds a little less spontaneous and fun, it actually makes it to where couples remain sexual. So sometimes being planful, scheduling date night can be really helpful for some women. Some struggle more than this, and certainly if women are really truly having a problem that is causing a problem in the relationship, they need to see their providers, and we can work on the different issues that might be involved in that low sexual desire, because sometimes it's more than just a hormonal problem.
Right, right. Well, Dr. Stephanie Fabian, I certainly appreciate you taking time away from your clinic today to talk to us. My key takeaway going through the book and talking with you here is that everybody's situation is very different. And, as body owners, we have to take responsibility for our own body and pay attention to what's going on. What's a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think what you just said is great. This is is an individualized experience for women going through menopause, and the treatment should also be individualized and tailored to what their needs and their symptoms are. So women need to feel empowered to talk with their providers about what's going on and how they can address these symptoms.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. So the book is called The Menopause Solution, A Doctor's Guide to Relieving Hot Flashes, Enjoying Better Sex, Sleeping Well, Controlling Your Weight, and Being Happy. And who wouldn't be happy if we can get all that under control? Thanks again, Dr. Fabian.
And the book again, Mayo Clinic, The Menopause Solution. And I have four copies of that to give away today, four copies that I'll be giving away in just a moment. I have one quick update to make to our conversation. I did mention in there that, she'll kill me for this, but I did mention in there that my sister had begun hormone treatment. Since that, I talked with Dr. Fabian. My sister has stopped taking it because she was having quite severe side effects. They were perfectly natural, according to her doctor, and they weren't harmful, according to her doctor. But my sister chose to come off them. So I just wanted to add that. And so, as I said, I've got four copies of the Mayo Clinic, The Menopause Solution, to give away today. If you would like a copy of that for yourself or for a loved one, you can call me at this number, and we will take, let's say, we'll take callers 2, 4, 6, and 8. How's that? 2, 4, 6, and 8. And I will call you back if you're one of the winners. If you're not one of the winners, I probably won't have time to call you back, sorry. But I will definitely call all of the winners by tomorrow. So the number to call is 800-495-7617 if you'd like a copy of the book. 800-495-7617. I have four copies to give away. 800-495-7617. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner, who says that many people hide from intimacy and true closeness in relationships. So we're going to find out more with him. We'll also find out how to help heal a broken heart. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you could have relationships written on a timetable, separate yourself. Oh, why do we keep contemplating while your other half's sleeping? Say your goodbye.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, June 19th, it's Harmonic and Energy Shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon Center in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their acutonic forks, Tibetan bowls and bells, poo-a-didge and rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Open phone lines throughout the show, so call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, New York Times bestselling author of The Perfect Storm and War, Sebastian Younger tackles today's challenges in America brought about by our loss of community with his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. We'll also hear from National Geographic writer and author of The World's Wackiest Roadside Attractions. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Real people, real life, real radio. Alternative Talk 1150.
If you could have relationships and with a simple handshake, would you?
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we're talking right now with Dr. Grant Brenner. He's a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City, specializing in treating mood and anxiety disorders and the complex problems arising from developmental childhood trauma. He's on the faculty of the Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital, director of trauma service at the William Allenson White Institute, and volunteer and board member of the not-for-profit Disaster Psychiatry Outreach. And he's written a great book. He's one of three co-authors on Irrelationship, How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy. Dr. Grant Brenner, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Vicki. It's a pleasure.
So I'm guessing we should probably just touch on this for 1 minute here. You're probably busy with disaster psychiatric outreach today based on the shooting this weekend. Are you hearing any of that?
Yes, so far we've just put out a message that we're available to help at Disaster Psychiatry Outreach. Certainly a lot of my patients have been talking about it. It's a little bit early for people necessarily to be reaching out for help or training, but we're in standby mode.
Right, right. Well,
right now people are much more focused on, you know, acute needs and finding out what exactly has happened. It's usually a little bit later on that people start looking for psychosocial support.
Yes.
So it's happening now as we speak.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. And we do, of course, wish everyone in Orlando well. There's a lot of heartache going on there. And we're going to talk a little about healing a broken heart today. But before we get into all of this, I want to talk about the book a little, Irrelationship. Irrelationship, is that a word or is that a made-up word?
Well, We made that word up. There is a word called irrelation, which means a lack of a relationship, a disconnection. And, of course, there's friendship and relationship. But we needed a word that described this particular situation that two people, in the case of a traditional romance, create together, which is a way of avoiding being aware of problems with intimacy while making it look like they're really working on having a good relationship.
Right. And you say the premise of this book really is based on something that marriage and family therapists see in their practice every single day, and that is that many people are looking for love. Some think they've already found love, and yet really they're unwittingly creating dysfunctional relationships as a way of keeping true intimacy at arm's length.
Yeah.
Sounds like hard work to me, but you do say, you know, intimacy can be hard work, and this is why a lot of people create those relationships. So let's talk a little about that.
Yeah. What would you like to talk about,
well,
about it? Anything in particular?
Yeah, about why people, what's the benefit to somebody creating a, I mean, this is a high-level question, obviously, because you go into a lot of detail in the book. But, you know, initial look at this, why would somebody choose to create a dysfunctional relationship or choose to be in a dysfunctional relationship, then quit and go and look for real love?
Yeah, that's a really good question, of course. You know, a lot of times people do quit and they look for real love, quote-unquote real love, but because they've learned patterns of relating when they're growing up in their family of origin, usually a child and the primary caregiver, you know, very often the mother, what they're able to find is so strongly shaped by their early experiences that even though people really want real love, they can't make it happen. They either choose people who end up fulfilling their worst fears, or they choose people who can create together with them a problematic relationship. So you have to think of it as people having kind of two sides to them, hence our logo kind of has two faces as well.
Yes.
You know, one part of the person is looking for true love. The other part is playing out these childhood dramas that we call song and dance routines, trying to be a good caregiver or trying to be a good recipient of care, trying to fix the person or letting themselves be fixed without having it work. These are the things we talk about. And they end up pairing off into dysfunctional relationships. They seem to not take much work because they're mainly what's familiar, you know, habitual. And it at first takes more work to do something different.
Right. You say that these relationships are really about control. They're not about intimacy and mutuality. They're really about control.
Yeah, controlling one's inner emotional state. So it often comes up as control or power over the other person. But what we focus on in your relationship is the effort to manage anxiety about intimacy. And what we think people are using in situations like this are something that psychologists call dissociation, which is a mental disconnection essentially between thoughts and feelings. So people are unaware of the anxiety, and yet it also influences their behavior, and so they enact it or play it out in their relationship.
Right. And so in the book, let's take a quick break. We need to take a very quick break, and I don't want to interrupt you, so let's do that now. And then when we come back, I just want to talk very quickly about the performer and the audience, the two people that you characterize in the book. And then I want to talk about some tips on how we heal from a broken heart, because it's never easy. It's never easy. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Dr. Grant Brenner, along with Mark Borg, PhD, and Daniel Berry, RN, MHA. They have written a book called Irrelationship, How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy. We'll be right back.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Self-help, healing, spirituality, and more on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. My guest is Dr. Grant Brenner. His new book is called Irrelationship, How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy. And, you know, some of us unwittingly create dysfunctional relationships as a way of keeping that true intimacy and love at arm's length. And you in the book, Dr. Brenner, say that the key players in that kind of situation are the performer and the audience. I wonder if you could give me just a couple of sentences on the key players that come together, and just give us a couple of sentences on each one and how they operate with each other.
Absolutely. Well, the performer is the overt or apparent caretaker, and the performer is the one who seems to be doing most of the work to fix, rescue, or otherwise save the other person or the relationship. That's the performer is performing. The audience is seems to be passive, is sitting back, is letting the performer do his or her thing, but the audience is actually working really, really hard. You can't tell from looking at them necessarily, but they're working hard to make sure that nothing that the performer does is really going to be working. And so that makes it possible to stay in your relationship, because one person is being good, and the other person is letting that person keep trying to be good but not getting anywhere.
Right.
So that can go on for a while.
Right. And so throughout the book, you discuss some great information in here about recognizing this and getting out of this song and dance routine, as you call it. You know, what does it look like for me? And recognizing, am I the performer or the audience in my routine? What are some, if you initially find somebody in this situation, what's the number one piece of advice you give to them to break this or to reframe it?
Yeah, the first thing is to become aware of it. So we talk with them about what pattern are they bringing into the relationship. We use the acronym GRAFT to describe some of the childhood patterns that come up with the caregiver that then end up playing out in adult relationships, standing for being good, right, absent, funny, tense, smart. This is someone who, as a kid, tries very hard to get good grades or needs to be smart in order to please their parents in some other way. Stays out of the way when they're angry or depressed, tries to be funny in order to be entertaining, and so on. So the first thing is to kind of map this out for people who have a problem. The next thing is to try to get them talking together. We use something called the self-other assessment, a tool which involves the 40-20-40, where I get 40% of the conversation, you get 40% of the conversation, and we're trying to create 20% in the middle for us to have a shared conversation. And the rules of this conversation are that one person listens empathically while the other one is speaking non-judgmentally. And we encourage people to take turns doing this because it builds trust, safety, and communication over time. And then we shift people into what we call the dream sequence, which is the shorthand for the a kind of a pathway to change.
Right.
Discovery, repair, empowerment, alternatives, and mutuality.
Right.
That's kind of the short answer to your question.
Right. And of course, you go into this in great detail in the book and give some really great examples in here. And I had a friend over the weekend who was flipping through the book and recognized herself in that she's had a series of relationships, and she just broke up with her husband. Her and her husband just broke up 2 weeks ago. And so one of the things that is always difficult as a friend, I think, is always knowing how much support to give somebody during that and when we need to, you know, maybe I've been through a breakup. We've all been through breaks. Sometimes we need a toe up the butt, and sometimes we need a shoulder to cry on. And sometimes it's difficult to know which one. But what's the worst thing we can say to somebody when we're trying to console them through this process?
Anything that's really unempathic is the worst thing to say. Something like, you should have seen this coming. I told you he wasn't the right guy for you. That's a huge problem. Another unempathic response is you'll find someone better, because the person is probably still very connected. And they may get angry at you if you say that, because it feels like they don't really honor and respect your feelings about a fresh breakup. Even though I know how you feel, sounds very supportive, some people will feel very misunderstood by that. So I know how you feel. Responses, you don't know how I feel. You've never been through a breakup like this. Saying that the other person is a jerk is a problem as well. Again, because you're not really sure if the person is going to agree with you or not.
Or get back with them.
It's very tricky. You know, I think the best thing is really not to try to say stuff, but really to be present and offer support and then mainly be listening. It's a little bit like when someone has passed away. A lot of people want to know, what do I say at the funeral? Say, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm here if you need anything. And in that case, less is more. I think similar with a breakup. But sometimes you can give someone a kick in the ass a little bit later on when they're feeling a little bit better, but particularly if they invite you to do that. You know me really well. Tell me, what am I doing wrong? And then that opens up a window of opportunity.
Right. So what is, you know, when I went through my divorce, I knew a lot of bitter people who really wanted to get me riled up. And I was not having any of it. I wanted to come out of this as healthy as possible. I wanted it to be a new, fresh start. And it's kind of hard because people, you know, do want to share their bitter story with you. So what's the healthiest way for people to process that broken heart? Because it does feel like your heart's broken.
It depends on, you know, it depends on who you are. If you're in a place where you don't really want to be reminded of the painful bits of it, then I don't think processing it is really the right thing to do. I think in that case, a resilient response for people is to put it to the side. Not try to get rid of it, but maybe right. Wait until it feels less raw, and then you can start to process it. And then there are ways of working through those feelings. You can talk to someone very close. It could even be the next person if they're responsive. It could be a therapist. It could be a group of friends. It could be a journal. A lot of people find journaling to be very helpful at that point when they're able to process it. But it's a timing issue between, you know, working through feelings and using distraction in a healthy way.
Right, right. One of the things you say is that channeling all of your energy into work comes at a high cost. And this goes back to the book again and some of the articles that you've written around this topic, that a lot of people are trying to escape intimacy by setting themselves up as being so busy, they can't become engaged in a real intimate relationship.
Yeah, we see that a lot. And actually, I just saw this morning there was an article published on May 18th of this year, the relationships between workaholism and the symptoms of psychiatric disorders, a large-scale cross-sectional study. And a group of people published a report finding that symptoms of depression were highly associated with excessive work behavior. Symptoms of depression, ADHD, and anxiety disorders were highly correlated with workaholism. So it's not just a theoretical thing. It's really been shown to be the case. And again, I think any kind of coping mechanism is okay in the short run, but at some point people need to recognize that they're doing something excessively, whether it's working or drinking or dating superficially,
right?
And have a moment of, you know, insight and awareness where they say, this isn't really what I want to be doing in the long run.
Right.
But it's okay in the short run.
Right. So I love the book. I think I haven't quite finished it, but I've read a lot of it. You gave some great examples in here and made me think not just about, you know, male-female relationships or love relationships, I should say, but also friendships, because I see some similar patterns in, you know, certain people's friendships and stuff. So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with about your book, Irrelationship.
Yeah, we do see these relationship patterns in all relationships. We see it in the workplace, we see it in families, we see it with friends, and we see it in romantic relationships. Though the book focuses on romantic relationships, some of our writing on the website looks at what we call corporate intimacy, which is a provocative term. Mm. How does intimacy come up in the workplace? And not in a negative sense, but in terms of how can we work better together by becoming more intimate. And I would invite people to come look at our website at yourrelationship.com. We have some videos on YouTube that also explain a lot of our concepts. And we're on Psychology Today. We have a blog called Your Relationship. It's been wonderful talking with you today, Vicki.
Well, you too. And thanks so much for being with us. And I should also give a shout out again to your co-authors here. Do you work with both of these?
Yeah. Dr. Borg is a psychologist and, like me, a psychoanalyst. And Daniel Berry is a mental health administrator and registered nurse. And we've co-authored the book, and all of our materials come from our collaboration.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Grant Brenner, of course, you're a psychiatrist, and I thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time. Appreciate your input.
Yeah, thanks very much. It was very nice speaking with you. Have a good day.
You too. The book is called Irrelationship, How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy, and some great information in there. All right, well, we will be back next week. Hopefully we don't have a horrible news weekend like we did this weekend. I do want to send, you know, all of our thoughts out to those people in Orlando. It's just a horrific situation, and sending them warm thoughts and much love. They're going to need it. And if you have questions or feedback on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617. Or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net, plural, info@conversationslive.net. Or you can find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. I'm having a brain cramp. All right, we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.